Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Today, Labor Day, we're going to broadcast a recording of an event that happened earlier this summer at the Lenzick Performing Arts Center. In conjunction with Folk Art Market, Nicholas Kristof, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and New York Times columnist, spoke, and we will hear his speech, and in the second part of the show, we'll hear the question and answer that I was able to do with him after his lecture. Here now is Nicholas Kristof.
I think people are always a little surprised that a New York Times columnist ended up writing about women around the world rather than about nuclear missiles, all the kind of topics that we associate with the front page. The origins for the book really arose in part when my wife and I were living in China. Cheryl and I were New York Times correspondents. That's where we came across the expression that women hold up ban dian tian, half the sky. When we were in China, we began to come across stories that made us think more about gender, and in particular, what happens when you do begin to invest in women and girls. While there, we met, in particular, this girl. Her name is Dai Manju, and this is in Hubei province in the middle of China. Dai Manju was the brightest kid in her school. This was 1990 when we first encountered her. She was the brightest kid in school, but she'd had to drop out because she couldn't afford $13 in school fees. And the principal introduced us. I wrote an article about how so many bright girls were dropping out of school because the parents didn't think it was worth investing in their daughters, and how Dai Manju exemplified that, how she had to drop out for lack of $13. Maybe you can imagine what happened next after Dai Manju's picture was on the front page of the New York Times. We got deluged with envelopes with checks from readers, mostly containing checks for $13. But then we also got one wire transfer from a reader for $10,000. We took that money, gave it to the principal, worked out an arrangement whereby that money would be used to keep girls in school, in that community. And if, as long as they could keep the grade up, then they would not have to pay school fees. For the first time in this community, your academic achievements would be a function not of your chromosomes, but of your intellectual capacity. Those girls were thrilled. We then called up the donor to give a report, and he seemed a little surprised that we'd called him up, but we explained that he'd had this really transformative effect on this village with his donation. He seemed even more surprised, and we said, you just wouldn't believe how far $10,000 will go in rural China. There was this gasp, and he said, but I didn't send $10,000, I sent $100. You know, as trained investigative reporters, we could sense a real problem there. It turned out, indeed, that he had wired $100, but the bank had had a little trouble with that decimal point. So we didn't know what to do. The bank had made this mistake. We couldn't imagine going back to this village and telling these girls that they might have to drop out of school after all. I'm not really proud of what I did next. I called up the chief spokesman for the bank, who I know. I explained the situation. I laid it all out, how they'd made this mistake. These girls had come to depend on it. And then I mentioned the follow-up article I was writing. And then I said, now, on the record, are you planning to try to recover that $9,900 and force all these girls to drop out of school? He didn't miss a beat. He said, on the record, under the circumstances, we're delighted to make a donation of the difference. So what we had in this village was a fascinating natural experiment in what happens when you do invest in girls' education in a way that doesn't happen in the surrounding areas. And make no mistake, all throughout China, all throughout Hubei province, girls have become more educated, education levels have risen, there's been more prosperity. But this village has truly been set apart compared to all others in that township, in that county, and in the entire province. This one, we've returned periodically, and this one has far and away exceeded the performance of the others. Dai Manju herself became the first person in her family to graduate from elementary school, from middle school, from high school, and then she earned an accounting degree at the equivalent of a community college. She went down to Guangdong province, became an accountant, sent money back to support other people, to start businesses. After working as an accountant for a number of years, she then started her own business. That was replicated in so many other areas with these girls who otherwise would have ended up herding goats or working in the rice paddy, but instead, because of that education, got great jobs. And the beneficiary wasn't just those girls, but it was the entire community. It created this virtuous cycle of development that is what set that village apart. So for Cheryl and me, we saw this kind of thing and began to make us think about these issues, began to lead us to report more about them in China, around Asia, and ultimately around the world. And it was that germ that ultimately led to Half the Sky. And there are two themes that we focus on in the book. The first is maybe the grimmer side of the equation. We argue that just as in the 19th century, the central moral challenge for the world was slavery, and in the 20th century, the fundamental moral challenge was totalitarianism, in this century, the central moral challenge for the world is gender inequity around the globe. Now, when we say that, I think people tend to think of that as hyperbole, as an exaggeration to get people's attention. And it's really not. We really absolutely mean that. And actually, to explain why, maybe let me turn tables on you and ask you a question. But I think maybe I'll excuse those who've read the book from answering. But for others, how are there more males or females in the world today? Let's have a show of hands here. If you think there are more males in the world today, can you raise your hand? And if you think there are more females in the world today, can you raise your hand? I'm afraid this latter group is wrong. First group was right. There are more females in the United States. There are more females in Europe. There are definitely more females in this room. Given equal access to food and healthcare, women live longer. In an equal world, there are more females. But this is not an egalitarian world. It's a profoundly unegalitarian one. This is the picture I took in Ethiopia at an emergency feeding center. And you look at this picture and what you see is hunger, famine. But what you need to know is that every child in that emergency feeding center was a girl. And this girl's brothers were doing just fine. And in so much of the world, where there isn't enough food to go around, that's what happens. You feed your son and you starve your daughter. If your son is sick, you take him to the doctor. If your daughter is sick, you feel her forehead and say, well, let's see how you're doing tomorrow. And the upshot of that is that girls have significantly higher mortality rates. There's also a lot of sex-selective abortion in much of the world, which is another issue. So worldwide, there are between 60 and 110 million women who are missing from the population statistics, because they have been, in a sense, discriminated against to death. That is why there are more males than females in the world today. And those numbers are just staggering. One way of looking at it is that over the last 50 years, more girls have been discriminated against to death than all the people who died in all the battlefields of all the wars of the 20th century. Another way is that more girls are discriminated against to death in any one decade than all the people who died in all the genocides of the 20th century. When you think about the scale of that, then it does seem to me that this really does merit being called the central moral challenge of this century. But there is another theme that we focus on in the book, and it's a happier one. And it's maybe the other side of the ledger, and it is that putting aside all the injustices, that just as a purely practical matter, if you want to address global poverty, if you want to address insecurity, civil conflict, then the most cost-effective way of doing that is to invest in girls' education, to focus on women, and to see the same kind of spiral, the same virtuous cycle unfold that we saw in that village in Hubei province in China. To put it another way, women and girls aren't the problem, they're the solution. There are a few reasons why that is true. One reason has to do with the fact that, frankly, rampant population growth is a huge factor associated with poverty in much of the world, and if you educate a man, then he will indeed have fewer children, but the effect is quite marginal. You educate a girl, and she will have significantly fewer children. It's a much greater effect on fertility when you educate a girl. Another has to do with something that is kind of the dirty little secret of global poverty, and that is that a fair amount of the suffering associated with poverty is caused not only by low incomes, but also by some pretty bad spending decisions, and those are disproportionately by men. I think a lot of women are saying, oh, that's no surprise. this research is utterly demoralizing to go through if you're a man, frankly. There is a rich source of statistics for this, and it's somewhat incompatible. It's country by country, but it seems that that among the poorest families around the world, across continents, across religions, across cultures, families typically spend about 2% of their incomes educating their kids, which is a great investment. Educating children brings real positive net economic returns. But in contrast to that 2%, about 20% is spent on a combination of alcohol, tobacco, prostitution, sugary drinks like, you know, soft drinks, and very extravagant festivals. If you could take, say, 4 percentage points out of the alcohol, tobacco, prostitution pool and put it into the education pool, it would have a transformative effect. And one way of doing that is to give women more control over the purse strings, more capacity to generate income through things like the cooperatives, and also more control over assets, more title over land, for example, more control over property. And those things, because they do give women more control over purse strings, do mean that money is more likely to go to educate children, to start small businesses, and less likely to go to beer, for example. The other reason to focus on women and girls is, frankly, that the greatest unexploited economic resource in poor countries is not seams of gold and it's not oil wells, it's the female halves of the population. Bill Gates, I think, put it really well. He was speaking to an audience in Saudi Arabia, and the audience was divided between men and women. About two-thirds of it was reserved for men, and then there was a barrier, an impermeable barrier, and a small group of women on the other side. And somebody asked him after the lecture, said, "Mr. Gates, Saudi Arabia has the goal of becoming one of the top 10 countries in the world in technology. Is that feasible?" Gates looked out, and he made the point that, you know, if you're not fully utilizing half the talent of the country, you're not going to get too close to the top 10. And I think that's exactly right, that just as a question of utilizing resources intelligently, putting aside all these issues of injustices, then it's something that we need to do to overcome poverty, to address these kinds of issues. Well, if this really is the central moral challenge, what would an agenda look like? One issue that has to be at the top of an agenda is human trafficking around the world, which really is a modern form of slavery. These are girls in Cambodia who have been kidnapped in rural areas and sold to the brothel. They're kept there. They're locked up there. They don't earn any of the money that customers pay. It all goes to the brothel owner. When one talks about this being slavery, again, I think people tend to think it's hyperbole. This is a girl named Long Pross, who I met in Cambodia. She was 13 when she was kidnapped, sold to a brothel. The brothel owner found her insufficiently cooperative and gouged out her eye. But when you see things like that happening, what else do you call it but slavery? In fact, there are a couple of differences from classical 19th century slavery, and one is the scale. The peak of the transatlantic slave trade was the 1780s, and then just under 80,000 slaves a year were sent across the Atlantic, just under 80,000. These days, the State Department figure is about 800,000 people are trafficked across international borders each year, And that does not even include people like Long Cross who are trafficked within a country. Some of you may know, certainly if you've read the book, you know, but you may know in any case that I did something that raised a lot of eyebrows 6 years ago now. I ended up buying two girls from their brothel in Cambodia. It's obviously unusual for a reporter to go around buying human beings. The reason, the way that came about was really from my previous trip to Cambodia. As a reporter, I had really just been blown away by what I'd found. And in particular, there had been one brothel that I'd spent an afternoon interviewing two girls who were locked up there. They were best friends. There was a 15-year-old who'd been kidnapped by a neighbor and sold to the brothel, and a 14-year-old who'd been sold by her stepfather. They were locked up, never allowed out, and yet just really sweet, fun girls. The 15-year-old, when she went missing, her mother searched all over Cambodia to try to find her. And in Cambodia, if your daughter goes missing, the place you look is the red light districts. Just a week before I got there, the mother had walked into that red light district, into that brothel, had found her daughter. They had this joyous reunion. In my naivete, I asked, well, why didn't your mother take you away? And the girl said, she pointed to the brothel owner, who was a woman, as the brothel owners often are. The girl said, the brothel owner said that she'd paid good money for me. My mother would have to buy me back. My mother didn't have the money. I walked out of the brothel knowing that I had a great front page story, and these two girls who had been the reason for it were going to stay behind and die of AIDS. It felt unfair, and frankly, it felt kind of exploitative of them, for two girls who were being exploited by visiting men all the time. And so when I returned as a columnist, and I knew that I was going to focus on these two girls, on Stray Ned and Stray Mom, and tell the story through this, and I didn't just want to write columns that people would say nice things about or would be submitted for awards, and meanwhile, the two people who were central to it would stay behind and die of AIDS. I called up the legal counsel for the New York Times and said, David, do we have a policy on buying human beings? Turns out we didn't. not then. I paid $150 for one and just over $200 for the other, and I got receipts. When you get a receipt for buying a human being in the 21st century, that should be a shame on us all. Truly should. That's one issue that has to be high on the agenda. And also, I should just say that I think we often, you know, psych ourselves out and think, well, this is sad but inevitable. Serenette, things actually worked out pretty well. She's now married, has a wonderful baby, wonderful husband. Her husband doesn't know about her background, and so half the sky will not be coming out in the Khmer language because I don't want her husband to stumble across her background. But Stray Mom, we took her to back to her family, the joyous reunion, and an aid group set her up in the market with a stall right next to her mother. A few days later, she ran away. She ran back to the brothel. The reason was that she was addicted to meth. Many of the brothels deliberately get girls addicted as a way of controlling them. I don't know for sure that that happened in that brothel, but in any case, she was addicted to meth. She couldn't break that addiction. Several times we tried, and she desperately wanted to leave, but she couldn't fight that addiction. I thought that it might be hopeless. But then, because of my writing, because of the work of NGOs, because of what other people were doing, the authorities began to clamp down on the forced prostitution in this town of Poipet in Cambodia. And the police didn't exactly close down the brothels, but for the first time, there began to be some risk that a trafficker might actually be arrested. It was very unlikely, but the brothel owner, I got to know her very well. I spent a lot of time talking to her in her brothel, trying to understand her business model. And she was just a profit-maximizing businesswoman. She could earn a little bit more money running a brothel and kidnapping girls than she could doing something else. But for the first time, she began to be a little bit worried that just conceivably
She might actually get arrested. There was a little bit of a downside risk. And in addition, the police began to demand more and more in bribes. So she began complaining that it was no longer so economical. And finally, because of this pressure, the bribes got more and more. She closed the brothel, released the girls, and turned her brothel into a grocery store. Sremom then married a policeman who had been a customer at the brothel, probably because if you want to get access to methamphetamines in Cambodia, policeman's a good way of doing that. But the upshot is that it really is possible to make a difference, even in places like this. And you know, there may well be prostitution 1,000 years from now, but there don't have to be 13-year-old girls kidnapped and locked up in cages. We really can make a difference. A second item that has to be higher on the agenda is maternal mortality. We tend to think of childbirth in this country as a joyous occasion. In much of the world, it's a reason why women die. Somewhere between 350,000 and 540,000 women die each year in childbirth. In the country of Niger, about a woman has a 1 in 7 risk of dying in childbirth at some point in her life. 1 in 7. In addition, for every woman who dies in childbirth, about 20 are injured. I'm sure some of you have heard of obstetric fistula, which strikes me as just about the worst thing that can happen to a person around the world. It's what happened to Mahbuba Mohammed, who's this woman in Ethiopia. A fistula is an internal injury, a childbirth injury that typically leaves a woman incontinent. She's leaking waste, dribbling waste all the time. She smells. She's regarded as a pariah. She often has nerve injury called foot drop, so she can't walk. It's exactly what happened to Mahbuba. She was married off at 13 to a man. She had no say in the decision. She became pregnant, delivered at 14 in the bush by herself. There's no doctor. Baby died, and she suffered a fistula. She's leaking waste. She has bilateral foot drop, so she's crippled. And the villagers think she's been cursed by God. They take her, they carry her to a hut at the edge of the village and take off the door so the hyenas will get her that night. She's 14 years old, but Mahbuba is the most unbelievable, strongest woman you can imagine. There was a stick in the hut. When the hyenas came that night, she waved it around her head. She shouted at the hyenas and held them off all night long. When dawn came, she knew that she had to get away. She's weak from loss of blood, from not eating, from childbirth, but she sets off crawling because she knows that 35 miles away, there's a village where there's an American missionary. She thinks if she can just get there, maybe he can help her. She sets out crawling. When it gets to be dusk, she's still in the middle of nowhere. She pulls herself into a tree to try to sleep in the tree so the hyenas won't get her at night. The next dawn, she lets herself down, sets off crawling again. She arrives half dead at the door of this missionary. He can immediately see from her injuries, from the smell, that she has suffered a fistula. He takes her to the Addis Ababa Fistula Hospital in the capital of Ethiopia, Addis Ababa, and I bet some of you have supported that hospital. It's an amazing place. She is operated on there by an American surgeon who's working there, one of the leading fistula specialists in the world, who repairs her fistula, and also she gets rehab to help with a nerve injury. And while she's getting that rehab, while she's recovering, the staff ask her to help out. They realize that she's incredibly bright and talented, and so they ask her to stay on, and she's now a nurse at that same hospital. It's a wonderful example of taking these people and turning them from squandered assets to real advantages for their families, their communities, and their countries. A third area that I think has to be on the agenda is efforts to empower women through things like businesses, cooperatives, and microfinance. And micro savings are as crucial a part of that as micro-lending. This is a woman called Saima Mohammed, who I met in Lahore, Pakistan. She had had the misfortune of being married to a bit of a loser. He was a gambler. He was unemployed and pretty much unemployable. And the family was just in a dire situation. And at that point, Saima got a $65 loan from a microfinance organization and started an embroidery business. She turned out to be great at embroidery. The markets in Lahore took all the embroidery she could sell, and they asked for more and more and more. And so she began to hire the neighbors to make embroidery under her direction. Pretty soon, she'd hired about 30 other women in the community. And at that point, she needed to hire somebody to actually transport the embroidery to Lahore. So she hired her husband. He began to have a whole new perspective on women's empowerment. Microlending doesn't always work that brilliantly. It's not a silver bullet. But giving women the means to earn money, to generate cash, tends to raise them in the esteem of their families and their communities and gives them more control over the purse strings in ways that echo through their children's lives and through the larger community. Another key element is simply education. And it's one that I think maybe more than almost any other can really change communities and change nations. And it's not just about building schools. There are a million ways to get more kids in school. One of the most cost-effective is something we never think about in this country. It's deworming kids. We don't think about it because American kids don't have intestinal worms. In much of the world, they do. And for a few cents, you can deworm a child, and that child will then be significantly more likely, well, will be less anemic, will be less likely to be sick, will be better nourished, and will miss substantially less school during the year. It's one of the most cost-effective ways of getting more kids in school. In terms of the power of education, especially girls' education, this is one of my favorite stories. Beatrice Bira, who grew up in Uganda. She is age 9 when this picture was taken. At that point, her parents had not sent her to school because they thought, you know, who really needs to educate a daughter? You educate your sons, you don't really need to educate your daughter. A girl should help look after her younger siblings, should collect firewood, collect water. And that's what Beatrice was doing. Then, I'm sure you know the group Heifer International. You know, people give livestock, goats, chickens, whatever, to families as a way of generating income, and then the family passes it on. Well, a church in Connecticut bought a goat, and that goat ended up in the hands of Beatrice's parents. And then with the income that they made from selling the milk, they decided they had enough money they could send Beatrice to school. She turned out to be a great student. She was one of the best students in elementary school and middle school and high school. She began to do very well in the standardized exams. Then she became the first person in her village to go abroad to study. Then a couple years ago, she graduated from Connecticut College. That's her graduation party, and there she pronounced herself the luckiest girl in the world and said, "It's all because of a goat." Let me just address a couple of questions that I think people have. I think a couple of the doubts that people have. One is the question of just, does it make a difference? In truth, helping people is harder than it looks. There really are problems with corruption, with just ineffectiveness, and with the fact that you try something, you invest money in something, and it doesn't work. Anybody who has traveled around the developing world has seen projects, well-intentioned, that have gone up, and then because of a lack of spare parts or a lack of this or that, they haven't worked and they've been abandoned. And I think it's important to acknowledge that there are failures out there. But anybody who has traveled in the developing world has also seen some extraordinary projects that have been incredibly successful and that have had a transformative difference on people like Beatrice. And I think that we sometimes also make the mistake of thinking that to make a difference, you have to actually solve a problem. You know, here in this room, we're not going to solve the problem of human trafficking or of girls dropping out of school. But what one really can do is make some incremental difference somewhere along the way. You can't solve the problem of female illiteracy, but you can sponsor a third grade class in a particular refugee camp in a particular country. And for those kids, it's utterly transformative. This is an utterly hokey story. It's so hokey, I'm really kind of embarrassed at telling it, but it really speaks to me about this question. And I think the mistake we make of thinking that you need to solve a problem to wade into it. And some of you must have heard it. It's about the boy walking along the seashore where all the starfish have walked up, and he's throwing all the starfish back. And a man comes up and says, "Boy, there are millions of starfish that have washed up. You can't make a difference." And the boy reaches down, throws another one back in, and says, "Well, sure made a difference to that one." That's exactly right. I think that another way we psych ourselves out is the sense that these issues and global poverty in general are really depressing. We just don't want to be a part of something depressing. I have to say that in traveling to places like Darfur or Congo or the brothels in Cambodia, you see some really terrible things. You see a 13-year-old girl who's had her eye gouged out, and you just want to strangle that brothel owner. But you also see the most unbelievable, altruistic, inspiring people out there working to make a difference. That 13-year-old girl whose picture I showed, she's being helped by another woman, Smelly Mam, who herself escaped from a brothel and is now dedicating her life to help other girls escape, despite death threats. And I come back, and my most powerful memories of a trip like that aren't of the terrible things that I see, but of these people like Somali who express their humanity by taking risks and doing what they can to help other people. To me, that's not depressing, but utterly inspiring. In contrast, what I do sometimes find truly depressing is to come back to this country and see people who express their humanity in no greater way than having a hot car. That's depressing. Another doubt that people have is just the basic one of, why should I care? One answer to that is, if you've actually seen a 13-year-old girl with her eye gouged out, you don't ask that question. And one reason in half the sky why we try so hard to encourage people to go abroad and to travel and to see these things, and we try to make it a do-it-yourself guide to foreign aid, but we really want you to connect directly with the kind of aid that you've done, because then it becomes meaningful to you. But the other answer to that question of why should I care is the impact that it has on the giver. And when we were reporting the book, Cheryl and I found so often that we came across a group of Americans who somewhat reluctantly got engaged in these kinds of efforts. And they were busy and had a million things going on and thought it'd be a sacrifice. But at the end of the day, thought, well, this is the right thing to do, and took it on somewhat reluctantly. And then gradually found this was the best thing they could have done for themselves. It gave them a pillar of meaning and fulfillment in their own lives. There's some great work in neurology and social psychology over the last 20 years and what makes us happy. And very complicated answer, and people are still working toward, but one of the answers is to connect to some cause larger than yourself. Another reason why we really want to recruit you for this larger cause is the perspective that it gives on our own lives. I have a friend who is an aid worker, a young American woman. I met her in Sudan. She had been unbelievably tough and brave in Darfur. She'd seen things that no human being should ever have to see, and had been strong, never flinched, never cried, always held up so strongly. And then my friend came back over Christmas vacation. She's back in her grandmother's backyard here in the States. She totally breaks down. She's just weeping on the ground. And you know what it was? Her grandmother had set up a bird feeder in the backyard. My friend saw that bird feeder and thought about how she had just come from a place where babies were being thrown on bonfires because of the color of their skin and the tribe they belonged to. She thought how she had had the unbelievable good fortune to be born in a country where we take security for granted, where we have such wealth that we can not only feed and clothe and house ourselves, but we have enough extra that we can help wild birds get through the winter. She thought about this good fortune and with it the responsibility that came with it. In the same way, I mean, the very fact that we are all in this room today means we have won the lottery of life. And then the question becomes how we go about discharging that responsibility. So I'd like to recruit you to get engaged in this cause. And my hope is that you will not only enrich other people's lives, but also enrich your own, feel happier, gain more perspective, and help change the world. Thank you so much.
We've been listening to a talk by award-winning journalist Nicholas Kristof, who spoke earlier this summer at the Lenzing Performing Arts Center in Santa Fe. We return now to Nicholas Kristof and the question and answer session.
And men who just engage in prostitution. What's going on with these men? How did they get that way?
Well, I feel incumbent upon me is to defend the world's men for a moment.
No, I don't.
I do think there's some risk of seeing the problem as men. And I think it's much more than that. The brothel owners typically, the traffickers who kidnap girls, they're women. The people who cut girls' genitals are women. I mean, often, arranged through mothers and grandmothers. In India and Pakistan, often the greatest tyrants are the mothers-in-law. Mothers, in fact, in India are only half as likely to vaccinate their daughters as to vaccinate their sons. It always strikes me also that if you ask people their views about wife beating, then the best predictor of whether somebody is for or against wife beating is not whether they're male or female. It's their education level, and it's whether they live in a city or a rural area. It seems to me that there are profound problems here with misogyny, with patriarchal cultures, but that women absorb and reflect those values almost as much as men do. And I think that for both men and women, the best antidote to that is indeed education.
There are these stories, and you've told some of them, about girls who escape from these horrifying situations, and they eventually get married and seem to have nice lives, but how did they adjust to married life and sexuality after a life where their first sexual experiences are basically being raped and sold?
It varies, and there are some who are never going to overcome that. One of the things that I think we're learning is that in the case of forced prostitution, prevention is an awful lot better than rehabilitation, because rehabilitation is really hard. And the experience that I described with Stray Mom, who ran back to the brothel, is not uncommon, partly because of substance abuse, substance addictions, partly because these girls have had their self-esteem completely destroyed. Not only do they feel other people look down on them, but they don't feel any self-worth themselves. So rehabilitation is often a real struggle. And that is also, I should say, a real problem in this country as well. But there are some personalities are just irrepressible. And there's some women I've met who've just been through so much. And they've somehow managed to get over these extraordinary traumas and are the strongest, most helpful people you can imagine. And I don't know how they do it, but there are some people who manage to have these perfectly normal lives.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, I was reading this book thinking, if I had been kidnapped at the age of 12 from Poughkeepsie and sold to a brothel, would I have had the guts to fight back the way some of these women did? And I doubt it, but I was wondering what cultural things, what educational things can be done to instill in girls that spirit of resistance that some of these girls have?
It's striking that brothel owners or traffickers, when they figure out who they want to kidnap, the people they choose are ideally illiterate, uneducated girls for two reasons. One is that if they run away from the brothel, then you typically take a girl a long way away, ideally to a place where the dialect is different from the dialect she speaks, so that she can't speak as well to customers, to police. If she runs away, she doesn't know, she's just out of her environment. But the other reason, and I want to avoid sounding like I'm blaming the victim, but there is a real problem with girls being, in a sense, too obedient. That there is a culture in many of the countries that we're talking about where girls are raised from day one to obey any man. And the upshot is that they don't resist. And so when a man kidnaps them, or when a customer tells them to have sex with them, or whatever it may be, they obey. And again, I think education is one of the best ways to teach these girls that they can resist, that they don't have to blindly obey anybody with a Y chromosome. And it screws up the business model for these brothels. A friend who runs a shelter in Calcutta, India, was just telling me about a Nepali girl who had been kidnapped and locked up in a brothel in Calcutta. And she had a little more education than was customary. And so when she was locked up there, she stole her customer's cell phone and managed to make cell phone calls to everybody she could think of. And she wasn't exactly sure where she was, but she kind of described it. And then her family sort of sent out posses and to look for her. The local police then tipped off the brothel owner to look out. And so the brothel owner took her a couple hundred miles away, dumped her off in the middle of nowhere, thinking that, oh, she would just go back to her home village or something, that she'd never prosecute it. But she was so indignant, and she went to the local police and demanded not to be sent home to Nepal, but to go to Calcutta so she could prosecute that brothel owner. And again, the police tipped off the brothel owner, so he ran away, but that meant that he had to leave behind his property. He had to leave behind his brothel. And I think that anything one can do to screw up the economics of running a brothel like that is just fabulous for the impact it has.
Education, as you talk about in the book, is really the key to everything. I mean, education for ending poverty, for mitigating terrorism, for lowering the birth rate, for having girls marry and have children later. How does it actually work? How does learning to spell and read mitigate terrorism?
Well, first I should say that it is not a magic bullet, and there are no magic bullets. In the Middle East, Lebanon was probably the best educated country around at the time that it embarked on years of civil war. In India, Kerala State is probably one of the places that is focused on girls' education the most, and it has had wonderful returns in many ways, but it hasn't had a lot of local economic growth. Sri Lanka did a great job with education and has been torn apart by civil war. So it's not perfect, but I think that the mechanism whereby it works is that it truly sort of opens people's minds to other possibilities. It creates employment opportunities so that people are able to go and travel and get around and see other ways of doing things. It creates possibilities to generate income that then give people more control over their own lives, more capacity to do things that will help others, the capacity to start a business, for example. And in the case of women, it brings them out of the margins of society to play a greater role, which seems to have some kind of civilizing effect on that society as a whole.
It's interesting. As I was reading the book, I was thinking about the ways in which the problems that you describe abroad kind of reflect on our own problems at home. And for example, the most repressive and sexually conservative countries, they have repression of women, they have terrorism. And then I was thinking of our own country and our homegrown terrorists that are probably analogous.
I think that's probably true. I'd have to think about that a little bit more. There's been quite a bit of research abroad at the origins of terrorism, and there the relationship with the role of women is, the causation is clearer. I mean, it seems to be partly that where women are marginalized, you have very high birth rates, And as a result, you have a huge youth cohort. And one of the things that correlates most strongly to terrorism and civil conflict is the proportion of young people aged 15 to 24. And secondly, it seems that what really matters is not so much all the people 15 to 24, it's really the young men aged 50 to 24. And when you kind of take the young women out of the picture, then that magnifies the impact of those young men, where you have things like polygamy, or where girls are discriminated against to death, who have fewer girls, who men are less likely to marry. So then it becomes not just 15 to 24, but 15 to 28. And so it seems to be the impact of these sort of young male circles and the impact they have on society. I think that you're right that there is something analogous, that a lot of domestic terrorists in this country tend to emerge from a milieu that is a little like that, kind of a wolf pack. But I have to think about that a little more.
Yeah. One of the things I found really interesting of your work is not only about telling these stories, but as you make it very clear, engaging people to take action. And I found it fascinating that people are less likely to be generous after they've done math problems. So in other words, engaging the logical part of the mind is actually antithetical to engaging the heart.
This was, I became interested in this area when I was writing about Darfur, and it felt like I was writing these columns about murder and rape and pillage that were just sinking into the sea without a ripple. And meanwhile, at just about that same time, for those of you who closely follow New York events, you may remember that there was a red-tailed hawk named Pale Male that had been driven out of its nest in a co-op bordering Central Park. And New Yorkers were just up in arms about this red-tailed hawk that was homeless. And I kept thinking, if only I could write about Darfur in a way that would make it as compelling as a homeless red-tailed hawk in Central Park. So that led me to the work in neurology, but especially in social psychology, by a man called Paul Slovic, has done a lot of research about what builds empathy and connections. And it is, as you say, it's not a rational process, it's an emotional one, and it's about storytelling. People want to help an individual, not a group. And we all know that, you know, so in some degree, empathy diminishes as the number of victims increases. Well, Slovic showed quite convincingly that the point at which empathy diminishes is when the number of victims rises to 2. It's optimal when there's just one victim. And as you say, that if you prime a person by having them do math problems to prime their more logical parts of the brain, then they're less empathetic, less likely to give. The other thing that the work has shown is that people want to be a part of something positive. And I think one of the mistakes the humanitarian community has made has sometimes been to say how awful things are, the girls with flies in their eyes kind of pictures. And I think that people want to be a part of something triumphant and successful. And so we wrote Half the Sky in some ways with all this research in the back of our minds. And I mean, that's one reason why we, for the most part, tell stories about people who may well plumb the depths of terrible experiences, but also show that change is possible, and that ultimately they typically were able to overcome these tragedies and show that one really can bring about change. I must say, I do wish that the humanitarian community would look a little bit more at this research. If you think about all the millions that are spent marketing Coke or toothpaste, I mean, how much more important is it to figure out how to market malaria or AIDS or human trafficking in ways that will connect with people so that we can actually build some kind of response to them?
There are secular liberals out there in the world doing good work, and there are right-wing church groups out there in the world doing good work, and ne'er the twain shall meet. But you make a very good case that they should work together. Are there models where they work together?
There have been a few, and I guess sex trafficking is one example where in 2000 there was a law passed, the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, which led to there being a trafficking office in the State Department which publishes an annual report including ratings of foreign countries. And that has been a real source of pressure on foreign countries to improve their act. That law was passed because it was backed by a coalition of liberal feminists and right-wing evangelicals. There is considerable distrust, obviously, but it only happened because they were willing to work together to some degree. AIDS as well, PEPFAR, the president's AIDS plan, I think was the best thing that George W. Bush did. That came together as a result of right-left cooperation. There's been something similar on malaria. And I must say that, you know, as a liberal myself, I think that liberals have not awoken to the degree to which over the last 10 or 15 years, evangelicals have become more engaged in humanitarian issues. AIDS and malaria, trafficking are all good examples. And if there were more efforts to try to bridge those gaps on areas where there is room for cooperation, then I think that there would be fewer people dying of AIDS, malaria, and fewer girls locked up in brothels.
How do the evangelical groups deal with AIDS when they have a kind of mission statement of intolerance against homosexuality?
Well, in Africa, AIDS is less an issue of homosexuality and more of heterosexuality. Condoms has been a battleground, and evangelicals have been much more suspicious of condoms and programs to distribute condoms a great deal, and liberals are much more likely to embrace them. I must say that that gap tends to be more of a philosophical one in Washington offices of groups. A lot of the missionaries on the ground, are, including priests and nuns on the ground, are handing out condoms right and left because they're in the middle of a battleground. They see friends dying. So I think that gulf is less than it sometimes appears to be at this end. And I mean, the other thing is that often the discussions of AIDS just revolve around condoms and abstinence-only education. But it is a lot more complicated than that. There was one interesting study in South Africa that looked at the most cost-effective ways of reducing HIV transmission to high school girls. And it looked at a range of programs, and it found that the two most cost-effective ways of keeping high school girls from getting pregnant or getting HIV were, one, to give them subsidized school uniforms, which were more likely to keep them in school, which meant that they were less likely to get HIV, and most cost-effective of all was to have a brief presentation in their schools about the dangers of sugar daddies, of having relations with middle-aged men. It turned out that the upshot of this wasn't that these girls had less sex than before. They just had sex with boys their own age. But those kids, when sleeping with boys their own age, are much more likely to practice safe sex. And the upshot was dramatically fewer pregnancies and HIV transmission, and the cost of this program was negligible. It was much less than a dollar per person reached, and paid for itself in reduced medical costs for pregnancy and for HIV. So, there are things like that that left and right can agree on and work together on, even while reserving their differences on so many other topics.
I find myself, and I'm sure everybody in this room does, wishing that there were more journalists like you. Why do you think there aren't more people engaged in these issues, writing for major papers and magazines?
The truth is, that there isn't a huge fascination with these issues. I know that for example, during the Bush years, I would write my occasional kind of Bush sucks column. And I would get so much feedback, and everybody would say, oh, great column. And, I could do it in an hour. It was almost like an F7 key on my computer. But in a quite polarized country, people like that. And then meanwhile, I'd go off to Congo or Darfur, and people, they'd read the train on the subway, and they have to be at work in half an hour, and they say, okay, Christoph's in Congo. Well, I really don't need to know that today, and they would move on. And it's even worse with television. If you're a television executive producer for a show, you know that you can send a crew to cover prostitution in Cambodia, for example, or to Congo, or wherever it may be. and it'll be dangerous, it'll be incredibly expensive, and your ratings will probably drop. In contrast, you can put a Democrat and a Republican in a room together and have them yell at each other, and your ratings will go up. Fundamentally, that is the problem we face, and I think it would help if the public also held news organizations to account. And ultimately, we as journalists, I think in many cases we went into journalism because we wanted to make a difference in some sense. And news organizations ask for various special privileges because they do feel they play a special role in society. And if they get those special privileges, then I think they should also feel some obligation to help report really important things out there, even if the ratings in the market are not as great as we would like them to be.
I was wondering also to what extent there was this sense of squeamishness and maybe prudishness talking about the human body, reproductive situations. You and Eve Ensler are the only people I've ever heard use the word fistula in public.
We're working together on the fistula monologues. I think it's true that there is a certain squeamishness. I mean, I always think that one reason why maternal mortality isn't written about more is that it, you know, involves blood and squeam, and it raises all these sort of the yuck factor, if you will. But I do think also that one of the things we've learned, I mean, I began writing about fistulas in 2002, and there was this kind of revelation, but once, and I'm sure I ruined some people's breakfasts in my earlier columns, but then people kind of, once they discovered it was actually okay to talk about, then the horror of fistulas was such that more and more organizations began to get engaged in and began to use it actually for fundraising. And so now there has been this revolution, I think, in fistula, and it's become a perfectly mentionable word. But I think you're right. I mean, reproductive health tends to raise sort of squeamishness factors. That we talked earlier about kids and how to get them in school. We're just kind of learning that it seems that one reason why girls drop out of school in high school is difficulty managing menstruation. And one way of addressing that, there's an Oxford study that suggested that if you give girls pads, which is an incredibly cheap intervention, it reduces absenteeism by half. But because menstruation is something that isn't, you know, that aid worker, it's just not something anybody wants to talk about, that it's something that I think people were largely unaware of, and thus you didn't have quite cost-effective interventions that have to do with it. So I think there is something about that, something to that.
Last question. So you were asking people to engage and to go abroad, and some of us are going to go abroad and some of us aren't. There is this problem of if you want to help and you want to give your money, who do you give it to? What are your favorite organizations?
In the back of Half the Sky, we have a list of organizations that we've vetted, if you will, and there are a million other great organizations, but these are ones that I've seen on the ground that I like, that we believe in. I think my advice would be to, and also for those who don't have the book, you can also, the same list is at halftheskymovement.org. I think my advice would be to find an issue that speaks to you. For some, it'll be education. For others, it'll be trafficking. Others, maternal health. One issue that you care about. Don't just give to everybody, but choose one issue and, you know, try to learn more about it. Learn it, figure out which of the organizations speaks to you. And then, you know, maybe get engaged in that organization, but ideally not just by writing checks, but also maybe volunteering, going to meetings. If you can work out a trip, a vacation in some way that lets you connect with the work that that organization is doing, then I think that is often just life-changing for you, for your kids, and, you know, really becomes an important part of what you do.
Nicholas Kristof, thank you so much for being with us.
We've been talking to award-winning journalist and New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.